bones are amazing things. They hold us up. They support us. They make us strong. But bones have other uses. In the past, bones were thrown by diviners, seeking out the mysteries of the future. Now the bones are cubes, made of plastic or resin, but they still reveal things to us. As they fall from our fingers and rattle across the table, the story becomes clear. Welcome to Bone Throwers Theater, an RPG actual play podcast.
Welcome back to Bone Throwers Theater and this special one-shot edition of Good Strong Hands commentary. I'm Jeff.
I'm Johnny.
I'm Jeremy.
I'm Jordan.
And I'm Aaron. And I really enjoy this system.
I do too.
I like it.
Although my roles were too pinpoint exact to actually benefit from any of the cool things.
And I think that some of the stuff that we could have been using Spirit for, we never got a chance to use Spirit for.
Yeah.
And I think some of that has to do with the story and how the story played out, as well as some of the...
Well, it also has to do with what talents you choose, because not all talents... That's how you spend your Spirit, is with the talents.
So you can do that,
or you ask your dice.
Yeah, and I, towards the end, likely could have started raising some of the target numbers to a 6, just to really stretch things out. And then we would have burned off some spirit because we would have been trying to...
Forcing the dice rolls a little bit more.
Yeah.
I've never done anything like that to you guys. Never.
No.
Right.
I did use spirit once for that, to add a die.
Yeah.
I was using it to fuel my magic, and I thought that was a very helpful part of the story.
Yeah, that's because you chose a talent that used it.
Yeah.
Right.
I did it a couple times for Crack a Smile, which I love that talent. That is a cool talent, especially for an imp. Oh, right. My goodness.
Yeah.
That's a good one.
You just wish you had rolled... more poorly, more times so you get your shadow step.
Yeah, I really wanted that. It was that and the crack a smile and the shadow step.
Yeah, so initially when we were talking about doing this, how we can kind of adjust the skill shadow and spirit tracks and make them shorter to where you advance faster. I think with a one shot, it really should be shorter.
Mm-hmm.
But with this being the first time we were using this system, I didn't want to make it short and have everybody fall to corruption and suddenly, like, the story ends because everybody dies, and figured that would be a terrible one.
It's not a terrible way to end the game.
There was one time we were playing a one-shot, a holiday-themed one-shot. It was a security team trying to solve a terrorist situation at a mall, essentially, in Star Wars. And he basically said, if you take this bomb beyond X point, everything is going to blow up. And so what did my character do?
You took bomb beyond X point.
I took the bomb beyond the point. And then Johnny's like, all right, everybody died. Jordan killed you all. So, you know, sometimes that's just how it's going to end.
Yeah. And so, but I figured with this one, we would definitely roll with a little bit more traditional.
Yeah.
But I think for the next, if we keep doing one shots with this, I think it could play really well as a fun campaign.
Oh, yeah.
Oh, yeah, definitely. Especially because you can add your talents as you get your skill points and...
I like that. It even has ways of removing corruption.
Mm-hmm.
But part of that involves marking permanent shadow as well. And,
yeah.
And then another thing is that as you become more and more corrupt, signs of that should show in your character's description. I mean, it's a fun system. I really enjoy it.
So talk to us a little bit about the adventures that are in the book, because I was flipping through the book a little bit during character creation. And I noticed that the adventures that they have in the book are only like a page, 2 pages at most. And basically it looks like the way that you set things up is that you ask a ton of questions at the beginning.
Yeah, so the whole purpose, this is supposed to be this collaborative storytelling, which, like I said, when I first heard the example podcast he put out, I'm like, this sounds like what we already do. Very much, what do you see here? Or how do you feel like... So I really like that. So there are a whole ton of stories, 16 separate stories, and then 3 trilogy sets in the book. And the one that we played today came directly out of the book with a few minor tweaks that I did. The thing is that the story that it gives isn't everything or every character that will come up in the story, but it gives you like different challenge ideas, different characters that are going to be there, and specific questions to ask that'll kind of give some guidance to the story. There's one of the stories that there's a tower in this town the tower isn't a chief part of the story as it's written, but one of the questions kind of builds some more of reverie of what is the tower for? Why was this tower put here? It can add to the story, you know, if the character responds, well, it was put here as a magical safeguard for the city. Okay, that definitely can play into the story. But if it was put here as an observation point, okay, we can use it, but it's not a central theme to the story. It's just a neat way to build the world. Because what he talks about in the book is that a reverie is a dream, and this is a dream that we're all building together.
Yeah.
It's cool.
That's really cool.
This is where it goes back to the never-ending story. You know, the Fantasia is whatever you can imagine it to be.
Yes.
So, with this particular story, I'm just curious, did we jump out of a particular order? So, because the bunny side quest felt like that was something we should probably have done first before we ended up at the monument.
No, so there's really no specific order. And specifically, and I think that's what's kind of enjoyable, friends and enemies, it gives you a list of people. And it says Flump, a rabbit wildkin who can't find his family. That's all the information that I have on Flump.
Oh, okay.
There's no more information about that. Hey, do you have to help Flump? Can you ignore Flump? Can you kill Flump? Flump might not be a friend. I could have made Flump accuse you of kidnapping his family. But I figure all of you built helpful characters.
Yeah.
Let's go ahead and be helpful.
And that's such an important part of the collaborative storytelling process, is looking at what characters are brought to the table and see how they interact with the world as presented.
Mm-hmm.
You know, like you said, if we hadn't come here with several characters that were built specifically to be helpful, like if we had built characters to be suspicious, then Flump could have been like a double agent of some sort.
Right.
And so that kind of attention to detail that the GM has to put into it is really important, and you nailed that very well.
Yeah. Well, I was just asking because it seemed like the Groat quest got us a bit of information that led us to how we're supposed to do that. So I was just wondering if there was something that we could have picked up from helping Flump, but we didn't need it at that point.
It could have. Because again, so it has friends and enemies, Groat. This has no information about what Groat knows. I added that Groat knows where Aura is. Because, okay. So it gives you friends and enemies, points of interest, and then these major challenges. And the major challenges for this one were discover what's going on, help those in need, stave off or hide from ghost attacks, find the ghostly void scions, consult with Aura, the ancient imp sage, who can help them cross over to death to defeat the ghosts, and then defeat the void scions by dying and coming back again later. So it's like, that's all I have. So now how do I get you from, all right, you guys show up at this field, now you need to go find Aura. And so I added that Groat knew who Aura was.
Okay.
Now, what are those lists of boxes on the adventure page? Like, I see a line of white boxes that are there. Is that story tracking?
No. Every challenge in this rule set is built like what we do as a skills challenge. So for a skills challenge where we have a target number and each person rolls and attempts to hit that target number. So for this line, this one is specifically climactic challenge, defeat the scions. There are 14 boxes. So you will have to get 14 hits to defeat the scions. And then at each, what are called milestones, gray boxes within the list of white boxes, those are when one of the scions dies, is again how this story is laid out.
So that's why it was so easy to take out.
Yeah.
Because we had filled up four boxes before that, and you just, oh, I'm going to wrap this. Well, that's the fifth box.
It's like, so I like that, and I don't like it.
Yeah.
I like it because it could, without specific guides. So if we went in with the whole idea that removing the weapon is what kills the scions.
Yeah.
Well, that could either be really, really fast, or it could be really slow.
Yeah.
I do like that this almost guarantees a pace, having a certain number of successes to hit. And so the way it's supposed to work is that everything you do has something like that. So let's say if I were tracking all of these major challenges, talking with Aura, there's three. And each one, then you're supposed to vary how difficult it is or how many check boxes it takes to solve that one. So that's where fighting against Grope had five check boxes.
Yeah.
So you guys had to hit five successes.
Interesting.
Okay, that's why it was so much harder to fight the skeleton than it was to fight the deadly ghost being.
Yeah, the skeleton was more or less the same difficulty of one of the scions.
Yeah.
So. And there was two of you versus four.
Interesting.
Yeah, that is interesting.
I'm going to have to look into the structure of that because I think that's a really good...
It can be very adaptable.
Yeah, very adaptable, especially for convention one-shots.
Oh, yeah,
like, definitely. Because then you get a lot of buy-in and very much structured for the way that I like to write my adventures in the first
place. Yeah, it's a hit point system is what it is.
Yeah.
It's just with this particular game system, it's a target success versus a opposed role.
Yeah.
Right.
So, yeah, like I said, really fun system, really great world building, and it's collaborative world building. And I think that if I were ever going to do a campaign with it, one of the things that they did during the Kickstarter was they stood up a Trello board that everybody could log into and make their changes directly on this big board. And so you could see the world developing as everybody would go in and add to the board. So each person got to claim like one of the folk to create. Someone could say, all right, these are the red caps. So red caps are only called violent by people who have made them angry. Red caps are normally peace loving. And so you got to define the folk, which was really, really cool.
I didn't approach them as necessarily violent as much as just hunters.
Right.
Yeah.
Where, you know, some of the questions that I would ask would be, and I almost built it into this one, what specifically did your parents not like about you because it is so different from the rest of your kind? Mm. You know, questions like that would build out your character, but also the world. So I think that things like that would be some really good questions for the campaign.
This was a lot of fun. There was one thing that when we were fighting the skeleton, I really wanted the skeleton to just like get up and climb into the suit of armor and then fight us that way.
Mm-hmm. Well, see, here's the thing. I was thinking along the similar lines because I was thinking that if you combined the suit of armor with the skeleton, then the rage would dissipate.
So again, a lot of it was off the cuff. If you guys had accomplished that,
sure,
you would now have gained a skeleton friend.
Right.
We could have gone that way.
Yeah.
Not what happened at the end of the five blocks.
I wasn't thinking that removing the arrow was going to kill the skeleton, actually. Yeah. I was just thinking of that was a way to move closer because it would be an act of restoring the skeleton because the arrow was what killed it.
Yeah.
You know, then you remove the arrow and then you can integrate it with the armor and then things can resolve better. Yeah. But
it also happened that just removing the arrow was that fifth success. It was like that wrapping the scion. It just happened to be what ends up checking that box.
And I like how open-ended that is compared to draining hit points or knocking something down to zero.
Yeah.
That makes it a lot more narratively driven.
Yes. Oh, another thing that I think is really cool. So at the end, whenever you do defeat something that is living or dead, you typically get the option to kill it or knock it unconscious. And if you purposely kill it, you mark one shadow, period. Because killing anything sentient is considered void-like. Mm-hmm. So some really cool stuff.
I loved the world. I thought that the field was a fantastic setting.
Oh,
it was
the field.
Yeah.
Oh my goodness.
And I love the blood red roses.
Yeah.
You're welcome. Just envisioning this field that goes on for miles. And it's just got nothing but like 4 foot tall rose bushes everywhere in it.
So like I was picturing like big giant patches of the roses. Basically the roses were growing over wherever the mass graves were. Mm-hmm. Is what I was picturing.
My mental idea was that the roses were literally the blood of the fallen.
Yeah. Well, essentially, yeah.
Well, what's great is I came in with, it's a field.
Yeah.
I mean, the actual description is nothing but tall grass grows here. But, all right, we don't have to roll with that. It's like, all right, let's figure out what this actually looks like to us. And I don't know. I love that with some of the way we play.
I love the Blood Lake was a lot of fun. Was there a lake actually listed on the description?
No, it's actually what's called the Iron Smear. A long, shallow pool that never dries. I went with a lake because...
I figured,
all right, there's a fear of lakes, let's do a lake. And then you added the arch. I'm like, all right, so what can we do with that? That's fun stuff. Yeah.
So if you had asked me what my vision was of what called me to this area, I was going to be like something like, you know how the blood has arced over and started entangling... The monument.
Mm-hmm.
Other things were going to reach over and entangle it too, strangling the heroes of the past.
Ooh. I like that.
removing their memory from history.
The character races were really cool. I liked the character creation method as well. It was very simple and clean, but it made some very vibrant characters.
I like how open-ended that event was.
Well, and I think that's one of the things the book talks about, is all of the folk are very open. They're open to our interpretation. I think that if we were to play here, and if we were to play with another group of people at another location, they're all going to have different folk with the same basic beginnings, but
very different. Because going through and looking and reading all the paragraph descriptions of the different type of folk is how I tried to incorporate how my character would perceive those different type of folk. But I know that depending on what previous knowledge of like stories, or like we mentioned Willow at the beginning, mm-hmm. and then when I see the brownies, I'm just thinking the brownies from Willow.
Uh-huh.
Yeah.
So you're going to get some different flavors of, oh no, brownies aren't that way. Brownies are this way. Or pixies. Because you got pixies, you can...
It could be any kind.
Any kind. Think of pixies from Harry Potter, and you're like, oh my gosh.
Yeah.
Yeah.
Whereas, you know, I've never seen Harry Potter, so
I don't remember the pixies from Harry Potter. Other than they're malicious, right?
Yeah, they're just like...
tiny little, basically like
candles. Whereas I pictured the pixies from Willow.
Right.
I was thinking of
Dresden Files. Yeah.
Or a pixies like Peter Pan.
Like
pixies. Right. So they're all very different. And so that's where, as a group, we come up with, well, what do our pixies look like? What do our pixies do? What are our traits?
Mm-hmm.
So.
And the cool thing is, you might meet like a paragon that's completely different from all the other paragons.
Mm-hmm. Oh, yeah.
Yeah. And that's why, to me, I think one of that question is, what is different about you from the rest of your folk?
I mean, that's
why
I say, like, one of my things of being a paragon was every animal I am, I'm a gray animal.
Yeah. You know? It's a consistent thing.
I really enjoyed being a rope. I'm not even going to lie. It was a lot of fun just tangling things up and clotheslining people.
Now, is Nerdburger, are they thinking about continuing with the product line on this one? Like, or are they seeing this as a one and done?
I am unsure. This was Kickstarter 2021.
Sometimes Kickstarters have like extra splat books as
and sometimes they have to wait to see what the reviews are.
Yeah.
Right.
The art inside of it is gorgeous.
Oh, yeah.
Yeah. The issue with it, I don't know how, that's why I'm not a game designer. I don't know how you could continue with this other than...
Well, you can do it like a second edition, revised rules.
And... Yes, yeah. I guess you could do that. And they likely would.
Take people's suggestions on how certain things should be done. And
yeah, for our information, I could definitely ask.
I think that, honestly, the system as it stands is very complete. It doesn't need a lot of additional material, no. I think. If any kind of revisions would be done, I would say that marking the conditions differently.
Yeah.
Like separate out the physical conditions from the... Or emotional ones.
Yeah. Identify them as that.
Yeah.
I could also see, like we talked about, some hint on the character sheet on how to use your spirit shadow.
Yeah, I didn't. None of us really realized when we were choosing the specialties. Looked at those. Those were different too.
Yeah.
Yeah.
You know?
I didn't take a look at those.
We all noticed the talents were different. But
yeah. Mm-hmm. Yeah, because pretty much everything else on that page, other than the paragraph description, is the same.
Yeah.
So we didn't.
Didn't catch that.
Right.
So I'm turning into an evil rope. A rope of doom and destruction and hanging people.
And I'm turning into a good imp.
Santa Claus.
Yeah!
So, I enjoyed Jasper quite a bit. I don't know if I could play Jasper for an entire campaign, though.
I enjoyed Crichton, and I think I could play Crichton for an entire campaign.
Yeah.
Oh my gosh. The only thing, one-shots are tough to really develop a character.
Yes. Mm-hmm.
To figure out who that character is and how they're going to interact. So sometimes I felt myself as like, Crichton probably should act a certain way here. I don't know how he would act yet. Because we spent all, half an hour building a character.
And very little actual character development.
Right.
Yeah.
Well, I thought the Anchors and the Fears provided a lot of good role-playing.
Yeah. Well, yes. Yeah, especially the Anchors. I think the Anchors at least for me, drove some of my decision making as far as being clever and spontaneous, which is that whole scene in the village with the bunnies. This is why Crichton just went off and did what he did without saying a word to anybody. I'm supposed to be spontaneous. Let's do this.
Yeah, makes sense.
So, but if we were to play like a full campaign with this, I would really like to spend a little bit more time with character creation and developing and knowing a little bit more about a character. But that's the way we play our main campaigns, is we know a lot about our characters before we start.
True.
So,
yeah. I think if we were going to do a campaign, doing it 3x3 and doing the whole, the typical character creation we do.
I actually feel like I do better with my one-shot characters than I do with my main campaign characters.
I think it's because you let yourself be a little more spontaneous.
Yeah.
Because I feel like with Jerland, not to get too deep in the weeds, but you made a character who was reticent to be around people at a time in your life when you were fairly reticent to be around people. So
that's true.
And Johnny did the same thing, because Jer and Chime are not characters that you should have to be decisive about anything, because they're both reticent and anxious characters.
I wasn't planning on playing Chime as an anxious character, but you started off with his office exploding.
With his worst fear.
I'm sorry. You
kind of created an anxious character in that.
Well, I think it's the combination that both Johnny and I picked fire as our big bad.
Yeah.
So Jordan's like, all right, two of them got big bads, it's fire. So fire it is. Fire it is. And we have a firefighter. All right. It's got to be fire.
Yeah, no. It's like, seriously, let's all roads lead to Rome.
Yeah.
Yeah. I mean, as far as this, like, with the Paragon, like, I tried to play it as somebody who's been around for a while.
And the idea of the reincarnation is a really interesting one.
Your role-playing choices did come across that way.
Yeah.
That's what I was trying really to play like that way. I really like that.
And also, you and I were both playing essentially immortal characters.
Yeah.
Yeah.
Which was like, oh, we're going to die. Okay, well, I'm just going to be another Jasper. And
Whereas Crichton was like, we're going to what?
Yeah.
And I was trying to like, say,
okay, really afraid of dying because he's still pretty new as a
being. I was like, you know, go ahead and sacrifice me. It'll bother me. And I was fully prepared to spend my three spirit to reincarnate myself to say, hey, you got to get all the way else up.
Because you could do that.
Yeah.
Yep.
Yeah.
I should have put my mind a lot lower so it could be more like I'm learning everything for the first time.
I always have a hard time with that and trying to figure out how to playing the traits into the character or playing the character into the traits. You know, I don't know. That's always tough.
So one of the things that got me on this was that the description of the Stonekin says that they feel everything deeply right to your core. So to me, it felt like he'd be a true thinker, but he would not necessarily be a complicated thinker. I set body as my highest at 3, and then everything else at 2, to try and capture a very simple personality.
And I think you did that.
Thank you.
I definitely think you captured a simple personality.
I wouldn't mind playing Cinch as a full campaign character.
Really?
Oddly enough, yeah. It was so useful being a rope.
The number of times. Like, so you see with your eyes, or whatever you have, or you feel in your spine, your body.
In the fibers of your being.
I could play Graham in a campaign, but also at the same time, you know, if I die, I just come back.
Right, yeah.
It's your perfect character.
Yeah.
Hey, sorry about that. I'm back later.
Hide behind a pile of my dead bodies.
I think the thing that made Jasper a hard character to play over a long period of time is his deliberateness.
Yeah.
Especially in the speech patterns.
Yes. Mm.
Because, I'm sorry, but you're going to have to listen to me just draw everything out whenever you go to edit this.
You did that in Angel's Guard, too, with the Mist Court King.
No, that's right.
I mean, which was a great effect for that. So
I was thinking of him as a rock ant and just going with it like that.
Yeah.
So.
Yeah. Well, I mean, again, the namesake of the book. That reminds me of that scene in Never Ending Story with the rock biter. And basically that was almost like the same speech pattern.
Yeah. Yep. And I think that one of the things that I think would be fun would be playing this with people who have never read or seeing certain things.
That's true, because that your character, how you interact, like a lot of my choices were reflected in what I had seen or read or kind of had, this type of character, they're this.
Yeah, and I think that's one of the cool things about where the Trello board, of being able to define the folk ahead of time.
Yeah.
So that way we all know, we go into with a common understanding that Stonekin in this world do not have that slow, deliberate speech pattern that in previous ages they did, but they were not considered very bright, and now they have fixed their speech patterns to flow with normal communities.
You know, I wonder how well this game would go over, not just for someone who's not familiar with Neverending Story, but how it would go over as an introductory role-playing game.
Mm-hmm.
Because I think that the system is...
It's simple enough.
Like, especially the dice rolling is fairly simple enough. All of the math is basically counting and checking off circles.
Yeah.
So I think it could be a very good introductory game, but I think it would be a very strong all-ages game.
Yes,
I agree.
I feel like there's a big trend to have edgy games, games with very much adult content in them.
Yes.
So finding a game that's all ages is kind of a diamond in the rough.
Which I for one appreciate that about this is,
you
know, having a 10-year-old daughter that enjoys role-playing.
Yeah.
And yeah, this is definitely one we could do with Hannah easy.
Yeah.
And it's not dumbed down to a point where adults would roll their eyes over it.
Yeah. I mean, I think the way the stories are, especially pre-fabricated stories, the way that they are so open-ended. When we took this story to some dark descriptions, which you wouldn't necessarily have to do,
right? No.
Depending on who you're running the game
with. Yeah. It is very all ages in its setup. We went a little bit more PG-13 in some areas than others.
As we do.
I don't know. We stayed pretty PG.
Yeah.
No, I think the Lake of Blood would have been like,
have you seen the Black Cauldron?
That would have been PG-13 by today's standards, at the very least. They actually created PG-13
for Indiana Jones'
Temple of Doom, right?
Uh-huh.
Yeah.
Yeah, okay. I remember that being a big thing. I was like, I want to see Temple of Doom in the theater. My mom was like, are you sure? I was like, yeah, I don't care.
Now they want to make everything PG-13 because that's the most profitable demographic, which tells you something about...
Yeah, like, PG-13 or R.
Yeah.
Yeah.
Well, it's because those are the people with money.
Well, especially the PG-13, because you can get the widest age range in the theaters for that without...
Whitest. True. I thought you said whitest.
I thought you said whitest.
I meant wide.
Wide, as in the largest.
With a
broadest.
D.
Broadest.
you want the most amount of people in the theater, and PG-13 typically guarantees that more than an R rating does.
Yep.
But we're getting way off topic, I think that's a sign that we've pretty much exhausted this commentary episode.
Yep.
Good strong hands,
good strong game.
Definitely. Thank you again for listening.
And thank you very much for GMing.
It was very good.
Thank you.
Thank you for listening to Bone Throwers Theater. We are releasing this podcast under a Creative Commons Attribution, Non-Commercial, No Derivatives 3.0 Unported license. That means you can share the podcast, but please do not modify it or try to gain financially from it. If you would like to visit our website, you can do so at bonethrowerstheater.com. If you would like to send us an email, you can do so at bonethrowerstheater@gmail.com. Our Twitter handle is bonethrowerstheater. You can also look us up on Facebook and subscribe to our YouTube channel. And until next time, may the bones fall ever in your favor. This has been a Nerd Circle podcast production.